I'll ask our marshal to call court to order.
Please rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Werke, Judge Connolly, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Renee Werke presiding.
And good morning, everyone. Today we have three cases set for a Zoom oral argument. I want to remind the attorneys that the rules of court conduct do remain in place. You don't have to stand, of course, but please pay attention to the time frame. On my screen, it appears in the upper left-hand corner. If you have any questions or can't hear or communicate at all during the proceedings, just wave your arm or call it to my attention and we'll halt the recording of the proceedings. With that said, I'll ask our marshal to call the first case for consideration.
Calling case number A221098, State versus Villegas.
And appellant counsel, if you will identify yourself and indicate who you're speaking on behalf of, you are ready to go.
I am good morning. My name is Peter Dahlquist. I am the attorney for the appellant. May it please the court. This matter before the court, the issue before the court is review of a lower court ruling denying the appellant's motion to suppress. The specific issue before this court concerning that issue is whether or not in the 1 minute that appellant was on the roadside and the 1 minute that the officer was beside his vehicle, no justification occurred allowing the officer to expand the scope of his traffic stop, remove the appellant from the vehicle, and confine him in the officer's squad car.
Mr. Dahlquist, simply for the panel's clarification, I just want to make sure it appears in your briefing that you are conceding that the officer was justified in the initial stop. If that's in fact true, we'll just go on to whether the expansion of the stop was the issue to be considered.
That is true, Your Honor. I do concede that there was grounds for the initial stop. The bar is sufficiently low that I don't think that we can win. I think it is important to note the reason for the stop, just because that is one of the Asperuth factors. But I can take questions specific to that if you'd prefer to proceed that way.
Your argument. You can go ahead.
Okay. This little delay because of Zoom. So the original, I think it is important just to note the original reason for the stop. There were two exhibits that were offered into evidence as part of this stipulated facts trial. One was the squad video. The squad video shows the officer traveling behind the appellant for approximately 2.5 to 3 minutes. The officer stopped the appellant driving down Highway 371, which is a relatively busy highway in the Brainerd Lakes area. The appellant then proceeds to briefly drive off 371, it appears in a manner to get off the busier highway and onto a side road. And that's where the interaction occurs with the law enforcement officer on that side road. The officer comes up to his traffic, up to the side of the appellant's car on this side road, and talks to him for less than, well, right around 1 minute before he directs the appellant out of the car and directs him back into the front seat of his squad car. The officer, upon approach, indicates that he pulled the appellant over for the reasons that are stated in the brief, that he was following a vehicle too closely and that he drove over the fog line. These are what are considered minor traffic offenses.
Mr. Dahlquist, when you described the road in the area where the pullover was, wouldn't it make sense if the officer was along the side of the car that it would be prudent for safety reasons for him to direct the driver in this case to move to a different location?
Your Honor, are you stating move to a different location, as in get out of the vehicle, or just drive a little farther down the road?
Well, either or. What I'm getting at is certainly this would have been an unsafe condition in December. I don't know the road conditions, whether it was snowy or not, but it was nighttime and you have an officer on the side of the road. That's one of the factors that the judge in hearing this relied on as far as the incremental intrusion. Was there any other option the officer would have had besides standing along the side of the road?
Your Honor, what he was doing is he was on, like I said, he was on the side road. He wasn't on 371, and the squad video and the body-worn camera video are in evidence. So you can see the specific conditions of the roadside. There was very, very minimal snow, as the squad video drives down, you can see just kind of probably about what you would see today in Minnesota. On the actual location where he pulls him off on this side road, there is no snow visible. It isn't cold. It's December 3rd. This is kind of the shoulder season in Minnesota often. It isn't cold. That's visible. The officer's not wearing a jacket. He's not wearing a hat. He's not wearing gloves. And again, like I said, the appellant is off on this side. I call it kind of a spur. And the officer is on the passenger side. What's next to him is a ditch. There's really no concern at this point of any traffic passing by. And it's not traffic passing that would be passing by at highway or interstate speeds here. It's traffic that would be exiting and could clearly see the squad video. He's really in no danger there. So there really is no reason to I'm sorry,
I didn't mute. That's exactly what I was getting at from your perspective, the amount of danger that the officer would have been subject to.
I would say zero. There's no ice, there's no snow, there's no reason to be concerned. It's really not adverse driving conditions, to use a word that my 15-year-old daughter used last week when we were driving around in the blizzard. This is just normal driving conditions in Minnesota. So there's no justification here for removing him out of the vehicle. This is really just a removal from the vehicle for
officer. Mr. Dahlquist, what about the trembling hands? I mean, that was the thing that sort of jumped out for me, and I don't think was present in Askaruth. So what about that?
Well, I don't think that's necessarily a justification to remove from the vehicle. I think it's normal for a person pulled over at night for a pretty minimal minor traffic offense to be a bit nervous when talking to police.
Well, I agree with you. And the several times I've been stopped, I'm nervous too. I've never once had my hands tremble. That just seems to take it up to a whole. And I get, you know, the nervous, the avoiding the eye contact, you know, we've seen that a million times, but trembling hands, I mean, that just seems to be different. And could suggest several other, I mean, it could suggest he's high, you know, which would suggest there could be all sorts of problems. So go ahead.
And I guess, you know, I think I agree. I think every person is a little bit different in terms of how they react. I agree. As an attorney who cross-examines officers all the time, I get nervous when I get pulled over. It's a completely different ball of wax.
Do your hands tremble?
My hands, I think, do tremble. My heart rate goes up about 50.
Oh, I bet your hands don't tremble. I mean, you look
I
too.
I tremble hands no matter what. Anyways, I think if the concern here really, as the officer initially stated that he was driving while impaired, that would justify the intrusion of having the appellant submit to field sobriety tests. That is what happens in any case where an officer believes that the person is high or drunk, is they typically have them exit the vehicle. They're allowed to have that limited intrusion to conduct, if it's this officer was not a drug recognition expert, but typically a drug recognition expert would do a Romberg test where they check timing, check eye fluttering, check pulse, things of that nature, look at the person's tongue. But that's not what this officer did here. This officer removed him within a minute and placed him in the squad vehicle. And that's that confinement, it undercuts that first prong of Askaruth, where it has to be, the expansion of the stop has to be related to the reason for the initial stop.
So what, didn't the district court make a finding as to the officer's suspicions about the driver's impairment? I thought there was something in the record. And at what point the officer had that suspicion?
The district court did indicate that there was some that noticed nervous behavior when he came upon him. The body-worn camera specifically shows that he asks this question immediately upon approaching the vehicle.
Ask what question? I'm sorry.
I want to check and make sure you're not driving while impaired. I want to make sure that you're not texting while driving. And I want to make sure that you're not basically falling asleep while driving or not.
Right. And you're the one that mentioned that the original reason for the stop is important. And I get your point. I think it's well taken. So if that is all, you know, if those are the first comments of the officer, seems to suggest, and I think there's something in the district court's order about this as well, that one of the reasons for the stop is suspected impairment, or at least that is one of the suspicions based on the behavior. So in light of that, you talk about the field sobriety test. Is that certainly one way an officer can investigate impairment. Is it the only way? Are you suggesting that this is, because this officer says that he in fact did want to observe the driver more and did that in part by removing him from the car. There were other reasons, but that was one of them.
Yeah, and I think that's that is the way. I think the field sobriety testing would be the way that would pass this constitutional scrutiny here. That would be the less intrusive way to formulate whether or not somebody was impaired by controlled substances or alcohol. There are incremental steps, for example, in a DWI case that must be found. It's whether or not they have reasonable, articulable suspicion to pull someone over for a DWI, whether or not once they come into contact with them, can they expand the scope of the stop by asking the person to be removed from the car.
So, Mr. Dahlquist, his only option was to administer field sobriety tests and not put him in the car?
I think if it's reasonably related to the initial reason for the stop, yes. I think I think you can go through each of the Asperuth factors. Was it reasonably related to the stop? I don't think so at that point, because it's a minor traffic violation and there's no indicia other than some nervousness of intoxication. Then independent probable cause.
Follow up real quickly and I'll let you proceed. So I find that a little confusing, your answer, because of course for a field sobriety test, the officer is asking the driver to remove from the vehicle, right? And although there are standard field sobriety tests, you know, as we both all know, some of them include just basic walking, right? But there are other observations that officers often make during the process of these standard tests that aren't part of the test per se, but get incorporated into the officer's evaluation of impairment. Things like trembling hands and other factors could be the carotid artery, which gets noticed later in this case. I mean, there are many observations an officer can make during the course of field sobriety tests that aren't the test. And I guess I need to have you explore that a bit more with me about this idea that there's some least restrictive alternative and the officer must only look at the field sobriety test.
Well, and I think at the end of the day, if this was a DWI case, that would be the challenge of whether or not each incremental intrusion into the appellant's rights to travel down the road were justified. Once he got out of the car, were there indicia that he was impaired sufficient for him to be arrested, sufficient for him to be confined? So I think does that answer your question? I think that's the appropriate level. I mean, it has, each incremental intrusion has to be justified. That's what Asperuth tells us. And to immediately confine when it doesn't really appear as if he is doing any field sobriety testing, it seems disingenuous from the police officer. It just seems like he's going on a fishing expedition trying to find grounds to search this vehicle.
How long was he in the car?
Over 12 minutes, and three times when he was in the car, the officer told him that he was not going to cite him, not going to write him a ticket. But notably, at no point when he was in the car did he then follow that by saying, "But you're free to leave."
I thought the testimony was when he was placed in the car, and I thought your argument was the act of getting him into the car was the point where the officer stepped too far. Once he's in the car, then you got other issues. And the officer is checking registration because it's not this guy's car and doing the computer checks. And then the guy is kind of freaking out in the back seat. I mean, your strongest argument, isn't it that he was put in the back of the car squad?
Well, he was in the front. He was in the front seat of the squad car, Your Honor.
But I mean, you're right. In the squad car.
I do think that. I think the strongest argument is the immediacy, how quickly he was placed there without any further.
Right. So the thrust of your argument, unless I'm getting this wrong, is that rather than just have him exit his vehicle and do field sobriety tests, he was then maneuvered or placed in the officer's squad.
Yes, I think that's consistent with this court's holding. And in this case, there's also a non-precedential opinion in DeRocious from 2020, which has almost identical facts to this one. I agree with you. I think the confinement in the squad car initially after only 1 minute really lacked any justification consistent with Askeruth. But I actually do think there's a couple points that need to be made with regards to that. I also think the 12 minutes of confinement was also completely unreasonable given those factors. The fact that he said three times that he wasn't going to be ticketed. The fact that the appellant gave the officer a driver's license immediately upon approach and a document, and also told the officer that it wasn't his car, that it was his uncle's car. The last point I think is important because the statute as it applies to no insurance is different depending on if you're the driver or if you're the owner. And if you're merely the driver, all you have to provide to law enforcement is the name and address of the driver. That should end the inquiry. The rest of the time, the officer is going over and over again, checking different issues in the car about his license. And he learns really early on that he's valid. And he knows before he even has the appellant exit the car that he's not the owner of that car, that his uncle is.
And Mr. Dahlquist, your time has expired. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal. We'll turn to you, Ms. Fogel.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. May it please the court. My name is Jackie Fogel. I represent a respondent, the state of Minnesota. As noted, this issue is a pretty narrow one, whether under the totality of circumstances and based on the officer's training and experience, whether or not he had a reasonable articulable suspicion to expand the scope of the stop. I will argue those reasons in a minute, but I would also argue that even if the court finds that it was unreasonable for Officer Collette to ask the appellant to exit the vehicle and sit in his squad while he ran his insurance and driver's license information, that intrusion was minimal and immaterial because the evidence that appellant sought to suppress at the omnibus hearing was not discovered as a result of the appellant sitting in the squad vehicle, but it was when they returned to his vehicle or his uncle's vehicle. And that's at what point the evidence was discovered. As noted, the reasonable articulable suspicion standard is a low one. In the context of traffic stops, investigations are rarely linear. Oftentimes, an officer is investigating several matters at once. In this case, the stop was conducted because of the appellant's driving conduct. He was weaving over the fog line, but it's also notable that his driving conduct was also evasive. As Officer Collette testified, he had looked away. He switched lanes when he was passing the officer, which might not be reason on its own to justify a traffic stop, but it is notable and can be considered under the totality of circumstances. He very quickly did ask appellant to exit the vehicle. It was just around a minute after the stop was conducted that he, I believe, learned that appellant had a California driver's license, and he said he didn't own the vehicle, but his uncle did. I think it's also important to note that his vehicle or his uncle, he said his uncle was the owner of the vehicle, but the registered owner was actually an entirely different third party. And I believe that was noted at the contested omnibus hearing. Officer Collette testified that the registered owner, whose name he couldn't recall, was listed in the ICR, and it wasn't the appellant's uncle.
Counsel, when did the officer learn that the registered owner was not the uncle?
And actually, I don't believe that is noted in the record at the contested omnibus hearing or in the body camera during the traffic stop in my review.
We don't know?
At which point, I know the appellant mentioned his uncle's name at some point during their discussion. I believe that was in the squad video or the body worn camera. But I don't know exactly at which point he realized that it was a different individual and not his uncle. I think so at this point, when Officer Collette had asked appellant to accompany him to his squad vehicle, he wasn't just investigating the possible impairment, but he was also investigating the vehicle's ownership as well as the insurance information. And he took time to run that. And I don't believe that 12 minutes, a little over 12 minutes, is an unreasonable amount of time, especially given the fact that at no point did appellant asked to get his phone. I don't believe that Officer Collette even knew where appellant's phone was. When he had him exit the vehicle, he never told him to leave his phone in his vehicle. I don't think there was any mention of it. So when they were sitting in the squad vehicle, it wasn't until, I believe, approximately 15 minutes and 30 seconds from the beginning of the body camera video, that Officer Collette is the one who had to ask him if they could go back and retrieve his phone. But appellant was rather evasive. He was short in his answers. He didn't assist the officer much in determining the ownership of the vehicle or to help him in determining whether or not there was valid insurance on it. So I would argue that the 12 minute span of time was, I believe, just as much attributed to appellant's short answers and really unwillingness to assist the officer in concluding the traffic stop. And I think, although Officer Collette did mention that yes, he was going to give him a warning, I think there were two separate times during the in the body camera video while they're sitting in the squad that he mentioned he was not going to be issuing him a citation. And then the last time that he said he was just going to be giving him a warning. However, whether or not he was giving him a warning, it's not the same thing as allowing him to drive away from the traffic stop. I would argue that on Highway 371, in the dead of winter at night, that it would even be a liability and probably irresponsible of the officer to allow him to drive without first confirming whether or not there was insurance on the vehicle. So,
counsel, if you'd help me out, and perhaps I missed it during the course of your argument, but what do you see as the reasonable, articulable suspicion justifying the confinement of the appellant in the back of the officer's squad car?
Yes, and just to note, he was sitting in the front, and I don't believe that.
Sorry about that.
Yes. That's okay. I don't believe that it is a distinction that would change whether or not it was reasonable for the officer. But I think that given it was December 3rd, as I mentioned, dead of winter, and I know that appellant had noted it likely wasn't cold. I would disagree with that. I think in Minnesota around that date, it was very likely that it would be cold. And as touched on earlier, I think it was a minimal intrusion to have the appellant accompany Officer Collette to his squad. The alternative would have been for Officer Collette to have to stand outside when, you know, appellant immediately didn't seem to have proof or any documentation available to provide Officer Collette. And I mean, he was also investigating possible impairment. And the 1 minute that he spoke to appellant when he was in the vehicle, that isn't a long period of time. And just he had him exit, but it doesn't mean that if he didn't observe or come to the conclusion that he was impaired at that time, that he needed to abandon that investigation. And I don't believe there's any case law requiring that law enforcement immediately proceed and do administering field sobriety testing. As noted, the field sobriety tests are only one method for determining impairment. And I don't believe that he was required to immediately begin those. I think it was reasonable for him to, rather than put appellant through field sobriety testing, to continue speaking to him to gather insurance information and confirm whether or not there was registration on the vehicle before subjecting him to field sobriety testing. So as mentioned earlier, because I think there were several investigations at the same time that were going on, that it was reasonable, I think the least intrusive of the alternatives.
I think one of the things you're implying, but let me make sure I understand it right, is that this officer was acting alone, right? He wasn't accompanied until later. Is that right?
Yes, I believe it was, let me confirm here. It was several minutes into the traffic stop. I believe that it was Officer Roos who arrived on scene. And I know that we see him after he returns to appellant's vehicle. So I think it's at that point after they've already exited the squad. So he was alone. Yeah, and I'm trying to see at what exact time. And I think that the officer's line of questioning was not overly intrusive. I think he was still investigating the vehicle, the registration. He was speaking to defendant or the appellate, yes, about where he was coming from, where he was going. But officers are not prohibited from making those inquiries in the course of their investigation. I would just maintain that I believe he had reasonable articulable suspicion to expand the scope of the stop. And I don't believe that his request that appellant accompany him into the squad was unreasonable given his initial observations and the fact that there were several investigations going into whether or not the insurance, whether or not he was impaired, and the fact that it was winter in Minnesota, and the alternative would have been for him to stand outside the vehicle. So I'm aware that everyone has read our briefs, and if there are no further questions, I would just concede the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Vogel. And Mr. Dahlquist, you have the last word.
I wanted to note just a few things. The state did raise in their brief that items discovered were actually after the confinement and after. They make this argument that it's immaterial. The intrusion was minimal and material. I would note that this is a what's called a Lothenbach hearing. So it's a 2601 subdivision 4 stipulated facts. Both parties agree by submitting the case that way to the district court that this issue is dispositive. So that argument by the state doesn't hold any water because of that. One thing regarding the driving conduct that I noticed is when he passed the officer's car, he looked away and moved a car width over. That's not evasive conduct. That's actually what's required by law, is to move over when law enforcement or an emergency vehicle is on the side of the road. And then he moved back into his original lane of traffic. So I would argue that's not even a moving violation. In the squad video, you can see when the other officer arrives. It is relatively early in the interaction between between the original officer and the appellant. He arrives and he comes and he stands by the squad car where the appellant is confined. So the officer is really only acting alone for a really short period of time before that other officer shows up. He stays by the squad car the entire time. He doesn't leave until the appellant and the officer move back to the squad. As I stated earlier, I think by removing the appellant from the car that was solely based on officer convenience. I know that the appellant maker, the state makes the argument, or the respondent makes the argument that field sobriety doesn't need to be immediate. So often in driving while impaired cases, we see questioning that occurs on the roadside when the person is still sitting in the car. Officers engage in what's called divided attention testing. They ask if someone has a license and insurance to see if they can facilitate that. Those responses, while often asking then another question. Those are kind of intermediate steps that they do before field sobriety testing. When the appellant was sitting in his car initially, when the officer arrived, when the officer asked for license and insurance, you can see that the appellant immediately starts to reach into a small bag that's right there and pull out documents. And he hands items to the officer immediately. One's a driver's license from California. One is a piece of paper. The officer then has him removed from the car. So it certainly appears as if the appellant gave him the documents he was requesting immediately. This fact alone argues against further justification for field sobriety testing. It appears as he was cooperating with the officer almost immediately. The last point that I was going to make is the state seems to make some justification that the officer didn't know where the phone was and that the phone was in the appellant's car. I think this undercuts that first factor that the officer indicates that he was trying to investigate driving while texting as one of the factors. If that was actually the case, he would have known exactly where the phone was. He would have been asking the appellant about the phone, and the phone probably would have been back in the squad car, but he at the very least would have known where that was. I do not have any more rebuttal at this point. I thank the court for their time, unless anyone has any questions.
No questions. Thank you to both attorneys for your appearance today. The matters were well briefed as well as well argued today. A decision will be issued in the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you.
Thank you.